Om Shri Sai Ram. Offering my most humble pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet, I welcome all of you, dear listeners, to this session of Prema Vahini. Now, do we call this a session of Prema Vahini, or do we call this a session of the end of Prema Vahini? That's up to us. But as described in the last episode, what we thought was over 100 episodes, we have actually gone through Prema Vahini chapter by chapter, paragraph by paragraph, trying to read out what Swami has actually written and discussing and, presenting it with some of the insights that Swami has given on previous occasions. And on many such episodes, we had guests who were always adding to the understanding and their perspectives of what they thought of what Swami was mentioning in that chapter. This is Sai Prakash from Team Radio Sai, and today I will be taking you through the first 9 chapters of Prema Vahini. Basically, the way we have thought of handling the summary of the Prema Vahini book is that this Thursday live, I will be summarizing 9 chapters, and the next Thursday live, Brother Bishu will be summarizing another 9 chapters. So we will summarize 9 chapters till we complete the book again. In fact, when I thought of sitting and going back to the first chapter 100 episodes later, you suddenly start thinking whether there was any, gap, because the last chapter speaks of the same topics, the first chapter speaks of the same topics. In a sense, the way Swami has structured this entire book is so beautiful. It moves from one point to another, one point to another, and slowly guides the sadhaka, the person who is serious about a spiritual life, towards fulfillment. At the same time, what we see in the chapters is one topic which Swami has picked, and there is a link to the previous topic and a step forward. At some times we think, is spiritual life giving up the worldly life and going ahead? And you get inspired when you read some of the passages in this book, and you think, why do we need to go back to this world? We should be a spiritual sadhaka, we should give up everything and we should pine for the Lord. And when you go to the next paragraph, Swami is saying the only way to go towards the Lord is to lead your life in the society, to lead your life in such a way, keeping that goal in mind, but living your daily life in the way that you should be doing it. So this whole book is a very beautiful treatise on how to go towards the Lord, and Swami has taken a step by step. So quickly I will try to summarize the first 9 chapters of Prema Vahini. It's worth mentioning that this is the first Vahini that Swami had written way back in the year 1958. And so many decades later, we are reading it again. And I'm sure several centuries later as well, these precious words of Swami will always be relevant, will always have the highest significance and influence for people to follow. If you look at the first chapter of Prema Vahini, the chapter is titled, Noble Qualities Form the Path of the Aspirant. So, automatically, we are opened up to the idea that Swami is going to tell us how a person leading a spiritual life should behave, should conduct himself or herself. But Swami starts off this chapter, this whole book, in fact. So if we were to imagine, this is the first article Swami is writing for Sanatan Sarthi, which would later be compiled into these Vahinis. And Swami starts off on a very, very different kind of note. He says, more than all the previous yugas, the Kali Yuga offers multifarious paths through which man can acquire discrimination or viveka. If it is education that is needed, there are many schools and institutions as you need. And if it is wealth that one is after, there are various avenues by which, with effort, it can be honorably earned. In spite of this, however, we do not find any increase in human happiness or peace. Indeed, there is much more misery than in the previous ages. So the first paragraph of the first chapter, Swami is saying that in this Kali Yuga, where you have many avenues to acquire discrimination and to acquire education, what is lacking is peace and what is lacking is happiness. Now, when such a lofty question is posed, why is man not having peace in the world today? You know, we would expect a very, an answer which is like awe-inspiring and say, oh my God, this is the fault that we have. This is the reason why we are not having peace in this world. But immediately Swami brings it to the most accessible, the most realistic, the most immediate cause. And he says, what is the reason for lack of peace in this world? He says, it is man's behavior. Pravartana. Pravartana or behavior. Now suddenly, when you look at this lofty issue of lack of peace in the world and you look at man's behavior, we are often, you know, wondering how this behavior of each one of us is the cause for the lack of peace in the world. Then Swami goes on to explain how this happens. And he says, what inspires good behavior? He says, only a good character. When you have a good character, that good character is what is, you know, the good character is expressed in good behavior. Then Swami says, the good character and the nature, the divine nature that is immanent in us, is the actual strength. These qualities that we acquire, they survive death. And he says, that is the real power. And he says, this good character is what really gives value and worth to anybody. He says, all the people who are famous today, if we were to ask, you know, people who are remembered, he says, but are all of them having good character? Then he says, I am not talking of the character that is, you know, labeled as a good character or not as a good character by the society. Then what is Swami referring to as a good character? If you look at what Swami writes next, it's really fascinating. Just to build up to that point, Swami says, Buddha, Christ, Shankaracharya, Vivekananda, and many such saints and great devotees, why are they remembered? He says, it is because of their good swabhava and their good gunas. He says, wealth, position, power, everything is worthless before the power of character. But then again he asks this question. He says, are all the people who are remembered today of flawless character? So he says, I am not talking about a society which does not value the ultimate character. And what is that ultimate character Swami is talking about? He says, I am speaking of the basic nature of flawless character, not concerned with the changes in society. It's associated with the eternal Atman. So in a sense, what Swami is saying is, people who have associated their behaviors and their characters with Atman, that character and those people are the ones who will be remembered forever. And he says, among the qualities that make up a flawless character, love, patience, forbearance, steadfastness, charity, these are the highest and have to be revered. Then Swami goes on to a very interesting part in the chapter where he says, how do we develop this good character? And he says, it all starts with every little action that we do. you know, several years before when I went to the huge Ganges, when I went to, on the way to Badrinath, where I saw this huge river flowing way below in the valley. You see this gushing river, Ganges. And then just beside the Ganges, you see this huge snowscapes. And you start, and you see the ice, the snow melting, and drop by drop, the snow is falling into the river. And you suddenly realize that this huge, powerful river is formed by these tiny drops. In the same vein, Swami is telling here that every small deed and action that we perform transforms into a tendency. This tendency becomes a habit, and this habit, you know, forms an impression of the mind. And he says that because of the way we look at the world, the imagination that we have from our mind is what creates this world for us. He says that knowledge of the world that we have is reflected in the way we perceive the world. But there are ways of modifying that. There are ways of refining that. There are ways of changing that. And he gives this beautiful example of Ratnakara, who later became the sage Valmiki. And he said, because of constant chanting of the name of the Lord and deeds like selfless service, renunciation, devotion, prayer, inquiry, he says, because of these qualities, new habits can be developed. So he says that these magazines that Swami is starting, the Sanatan Sarthi magazine that was just started way back in 1958, and since this being the first article, he says, it is to stress, to talk about this character and to talk about the ways of reshaping this character that these magazines are started and these periodicals have started. These are not for name and fame. He says, practice is important. You may read so many books, but practice is important. Just by reading one book, you cannot get viveka or discrimination. Along with this, communal living is essential. Without that, reading simply to spend the time, these feelings will also go with the time. After that, what is it that remains with you? So Swami is saying that just because you read something, you're not a wise person. What is more important than reading is putting it into practice, as Swami has always stood for. So the first chapter that Swami wrote way back in 1958, you know, if you were to summarize the points in this chapter, Swami says, in spite of easy access to knowledge and wealth, there is no peace and happiness in today's world. What is the reason for this? Lack of happiness and peace. Man's behavior is the reason for this. And what does this behavior lead one to? He says behavior forms habits, habits form tendencies, and that finally results into your character. And he says good character is the most powerful aspect. Character is power. He says, many people may say knowledge is power, but I would say no, I disagree, and I say character is power. And then he says, good character can be built by changing the habits and the way of life. So the first chapter, you know, gives us a lot of hope in the sense that shaping and reshaping your character is very much in our hands. And if we decide today that we want to do it, we can do it. So moving on to the second chapter, Swami says, you know, suppose we want to learn something. We want to learn something new. We want to acquire some knowledge. What do? Obviously, first thing we do is go and read books. But in today's day and age, the first thing we do is, of course, to look up Google. And that is also, in a sense, a way of reading the book. It's just reading online. But we read. But then there is a subtle difference. He says, when you are reading to acquire knowledge, you may acquire some knowledge by reading books, but is that kind of knowledge adequate for a spiritual growth? Is that kind of knowledge enough? What does it mean? So that is what Swami touches upon in the chapter 2. The name of the chapter is The Study of Books and One-Pointedness. So when we are reading books, what is it? We all know that concentration is one of the most important aspects of study. But is concentration the only thing? So the way Swami starts out is, he says, there are plenty of books which are available here. in today's day and age. He says the books, the Vedas, the Shastras, Puranas, all are available. Facilities for training the mind are plenty, but there is no contentment in partaking of the nectar. He says there is only outward show of the binding and the books. He says the books look very grand. You know, you put them on a high pedestal, possibly in a glass case in the back of your living room, so that when a guest comes and he sees the glass case and says, "Oh my God, you have read so many books." Swami says that is not what is important. In fact, this paragraph is very beautiful, and he says, "An attractive binding and title, a beautiful picture, these are what the reader seeks, namely transitory pleasure and momentary contentment." This analogy that Swami has used is so beautiful. He says the outward binding and the beauty of the book is just like a show. It is like a distraction to the actual content which is inside. Just as the outward binding is not crucial to the content inside, he says reading of these books alone is not enough if you do not put them into practice. He says only those who by means of discrimination select the books they read and practice what they read can realize the truth and enjoy everlasting bliss. So the first point is to select the right kind of books. The second is to put it into practice and then realize the truth and enjoy everlasting bliss. Only these live worthwhile lives. So those who seek the highest path and who revel in the thoughts of God should strive to read only the life history of saints and sages and books which help the contemplation of the divine. Aimless reading of books, all and sundry and whatever comes to hand, will make confusion and only worse confounded. It gives no profit and confers no peace. So Swami is telling in this paragraph the kind of books that we should read. Yes, Swami has said that reading the lives of saints is a very, very important and a useful tool, because you realize that their level of surrender, their level of love, and then you get inspired. A heart, a pure heart is one which gets inspired. How do we read? How should we read these books? Swami says, ekagrata, with concentration, one-pointed concentration, one-pointedness. And Swami adds a beautiful dimension to this ekagrata. He says, one-pointed steadfastness, samadrishti, is shubhadrishti. That is, samadrishti. You start seeing the entire creation as one. He says, the one-pointedness with which you have to read a book, with that one-pointed focus, when you see this entire creation, and you should see this entire creation as a reflection of the divine, as divine himself. So he says, no one is high and no one is low. You should say that the entire creation is one. You should see unity in this entire creation. All creation must appear to his eyes as equally auspicious. He must look upon all beings with as much love and faith as he has in himself. For there is nothing evil in creation, not even an iota. Evil appears as such only through faulty vision. Creation gets colored by the nature of the glasses we wear. By itself, it is eternally pure and holy. So what Swami says is, when you select the right kind of book, when you have the right attitude to reading the book with concentration and one-pointedness, slowly you will start seeing the unity in this entire creation. And you will start realizing that every fault that you see in this creation is in the drishti and not in the srishti. So he says it is like the colored glasses that we wear. And he says by itself the creation is divine and it is eternally pure and holy. So if you were to summarize this chapter, Swami is basically bringing two, three important points. And he says there are enough and many, many books. And, you know, to put it in today's modern parlance, there is enough knowledge and information out there on the net or on the books. But just having this information, is that sufficient? No. What Swami says is you have to develop one-pointedness, and you should read the right kind of books. And when you're reading the right kind of books and having the one-pointedness, the way that one-pointedness expresses itself in daily life is by you seeing unity in the entire creation. So when you're able to see unity, he says, samadrishti shubhadrishti. So when that ekagrata, that one-pointedness leads towards seeing unity in this entire creation, He says, that is what is ekagrata and that is what is most essential. And don't try to, when you start seeing unity in this creation, you will see there is only goodness. And there is, any fault that you're seeing is because of the colored glasses that you are wearing. So moving on to the next chapter, you know, the first chapter Swami told us what is most important, that behavior is most important and character is most important. And then Swami says, in this pursuit of good character, if you were to read books, what kind of books you should read and what is the approach, what is that concentration and ekagrata with which you have to read the books. Now going to the third chapter, Swami gives another beautiful dimension to this ekagrata or one-pointedness. The chapter is called Sadhana, the Way of Life. And you know, looking at these two chapters, Swami says there are, it's almost like there are three meanings of ekagrata, one-pointedness. The first meaning is one-pointedness. So it is more akin to like concentration. So when you're reading a book, you have one-pointed concentration. That is one meaning of ekagrata. And then the second meaning is just as we discussed in the previous chapter, seeing unity in this entire creation. That is another aspect of ekagrata. And the third aspect is steadfastness. So he says ekagrata is steadfastness. What are we to be steadfast about? What are we to be steadfast in? Rather, what should we do in our daily lives with an attitude of steadfastness? And here Swami gives a very, very beautiful point. He says, this chapter itself is called Sadhana, the Way of Life. And he says, you should sit and ask this question. How did the Mahatmas and Mahapurushas attain perfection? So when they can do it, why can't I do it? So the question Swami is saying is, you should challenge yourself. You should ask this self, yourself this question. When they could do it, why can't I do it? He says, the first step towards this goal, to achieving this perfection, is not to see the faults and weaknesses of others. Just like Swami said in the previous chapter, that there is nothing wrong in this creation. If you find a fault in this creation, it is because of the colored glasses that you are wearing. So the first step in sadhana that we have to do is, do not spend any time in discovering the faults and weaknesses of others. So he says, the first step, the first sadhana is, search for the faults and weaknesses within thyself and strive to correct them and become perfect. So how do we do that? He says, every day has its morning and an evening. And he says, when every day, you fill every day with good deeds. When you start the day with good deeds, you fill the day with good deeds. Because every deed, like how Swami said in the chapter 1, every action adds up to a habit to a tendency to a behavior, and that ultimately forms the character. So he says, let's start, fill your days with good deeds. And he says, when you do that, the evening itself, when you're blessed with deep sleep, that itself is samadhi. So when you fill your day with good deeds, when you sleep at night, that itself is samadhi. And he says, you know, when two people grow up in the same conditions, in the same situations, in the same environment, like twins or brothers, sometimes they have different natures. Sometimes one person turns out to be very good and the other person not very good. He says, why is this? Why do we find this differentiation when all the external parameters are the same? Swami says, it is because of the habits. It is because of the behavior. So if one person's behavior is good, he acquires a good character. If the other person's behavior is not good, he doesn't acquire a good character. He says, man is a creature of character. So the one thing that defines a human being, the one thing that defines a person, is his character, his or her character. So character is at the core, at the basis of everything that we stand for. So this chapter, again, if you look at the points, the salient points that Swami has touched upon, ekagrata also means steadfastness. And this steadfastness is expressed by not seeing the faults in others. So what is more important is to see the faults within ourselves and to see how we can overcome these faults. And he also says, develop good character. So when you want to develop good character, it has to start with the deeds, then the behaviors and the habits and the tendencies. So that is what solidify into a good character. And this is a very, very hopeful message that Swami is giving us, that, you know, sometimes people say, oh, this is because of the past birth and this is because of previous birth, that so-and-so is having this problem, or so-and-so is not behaving properly, or so-and-so is having this kind of a tendency or a, you know, habit. But Swami is saying that all this can be overcome. All these habits, all these tendencies can be overcome when we start filling each and every day with good deeds. So now quickly moving on to the next chapter, the fourth chapter, Swami says, you know, Swami says, yes, you have got this ekagrata. Now you have got steadfastness, you have got this one-pointedness. What is it that we have to achieve with this steadfastness? What is it that we have to achieve with this ekagrata? And how to realize this? So that is what Swami is speaking, Swami is teaching us in this chapter 4. The chapter's name is The Real Nature of the Life of Man. So that's the chapter's name. And the first paragraph, Swami says, to a superficial observer, the life of man appears as an endless round of eating and drinking, toiling and sleeping. But verily, life has a much larger, much greater meaning, a much deeper significance. Life is a sacrifice, a yajna. Each little act is an offering to the Lord. If the day is spent in deeds performed in this spirit of surrender, what else can sleep be except samadhi? You know, continuing from the point that Swami told in the previous chapter, he says, if you fill every moment of your waking life with good deeds, the night when you sleep on your bed, that itself is samadhi. Here again, Swami is saying that life has a much greater meaning, and one way of looking at life is that life is a big yajna. And in this yajna, what are you doing? Every action of yours, you are offering to the fire. This great sacrifice that is going on, life is a sacrifice, a yajna. And every action you are offering to the Lord. So this is one way of looking at this life, that life itself is a yajna. You know, on several occasions, Swami has mentioned that 70% of sadhana is inquiry. So he says, you're doing these good actions, you're offering it to the Lord, but along with that, what is important is that inquiry. And what does that inquiry ultimately lead you to? To what realization does it ultimately lead you to? He says, tat tvam asi. He says, you are that, and you are the Atman. That is the ultimate truth. And one of the greatest sins, like during the course of our action, whenever we do any action, at the back of our mind, can we have this consciousness that I am not just this body? That I am not limited to just this body? He says, man commits the great fault of identifying himself with the body. You are not the body. You are the Atman. But the purpose of this body is to involve in selfless service. So what Swami is saying is, yes, you have this body. You have to do actions with this body, which are the actions of sacrifice that you're putting into the fire. At the same time, do not be identified with the body. He says, it is for the sake of that Atma Tattva that you have this body. And so in the attempt to realize Parameshwara here and now, you must be prepared to offer this body at any moment as a sacrifice. So he says, not just offering your actions as an offering to the Lord in this huge sacrifice or yajnam, you should be able to offer your body itself into the sacrifice. Utilize your authority over this body to foster the welfare of the world. This body is but an instrument, an implement given by God. Let it serve its purpose. But until the realization of the purpose for which the implement is given, it is your duty to watch it vigilantly and protect it from injury and disablement. During winter, woolen clothes are worn to withstand the rigor of the cold gales. But when the cold subsides, they are discarded. So too, when the cold gales of material life do not affect us in the least, the material body is no longer essential. One is conscious of only the incorporeal body. So this paragraph is so beautiful. He says how the human body has to be looked at and how we have to use this human body. He says, till you reach a level where you have no attachment and you have no, you know, binding to these material pleasures, to material life, till that point you have to look after your body. You have to use this body in selfless service. And by doing selfless service, you are actually identifying the unity in this creation. So the moment you do selfless service, you are not serving somebody else. You are serving yourself. You start seeing this unity in creation. And because of this unity in creation, you start understanding that you are beyond this body, you are the Atman. And then he says, how do we worship God? There is again this beautiful chapter, beautiful discourse in the 1991 Summer Shower series. I think it's the second discourse where Swami really brings out step by step how human beings have always looked at God in nature. The first realization that there is a power beyond us is when we see nature, when we see the volcanoes, when we see the ocean, when we see the mountains, when we see seasons, when we see the sun, when we see the moon. So man always revered God in nature. And he says, man worships God and nature is the medium for the worship. So initially, man started looking at sun and said, sun is itself is God. The moon is God. The trees are God. The mountains are God. And then he started seeing that there is a power behind the sun. If sun is God, how powerful is the power behind the sun? So he says, nature then becomes a medium, an expression of God. And you use nature as a medium to worship God. He said, all actions done from dawn to dusk have to be offered to the divine. Slowly the feeling of me and thee is gone and life itself transmutes into this Hariparayanam. So he says, when you start using everything that you see in nature as an offering, as a medium to offer your worship to the Lord, to express your love to the Lord, the entire life becomes a Hariparayanam. And when you, he gives this beautiful example, he says, you know, when there is a downpour of rain, when you just look at that beautiful scene, there is no difference between the sky and the earth. There is a downpour of rain and the dark clouds are just falling down as torrential rain. The sky, there is no horizon. The earth and the sky are one. So in the same way, he says, when you use nature, when you use nature to worship the Lord, slowly there is no difference between the Lord and us. He says, nature combines the Lord and the devotee. And he says, that is one of a very powerful ways of offering our gratitude and prayer to the Lord. Slowly, all the difference disappears. So, in this yajna of life, what the salient points in this chapter is, he says, look at life as a yajna, as a sacrifice, and offer all your actions in this yajna. But it's not only the actions that you need to offer, be ready to offer your body itself, because your body is also part of this offering. Your body is part of nature, which is a part of offering. And you have been given this responsibility of looking after this body. You can use it the way you want and offer it when the work is completed. So he says, when you get that realization, when you get detachment from material life, you offer this body also to the Lord. And through nature, you can express your gratitude and love to the divine. So he says, the most essential aspect or the purpose of life is to understand that you are not this body and tattvamasi, you are that, you are the Atman. That is what is the most important aspect of our existence. And he says the way to reach this realization is via selfless service. Selfless service, when it is done without expecting any results and offering every action to the Lord, he says that itself is a very powerful and a royal path to understand tattvamasi. So this is chapter 4. And now when we think of this life as a yajna, as a sacrifice, you start, oh my God, what am I going to do? Every action I'll have to start thinking about, how do I offer this to the Lord? How do I, you know, am I dedicating this to the Lord? Am I going the right path? I think if you think too much about all these things, the only thing that will happen is possibly our blood pressure and our hypertension will go up. But the Lord is ever compassionate. And over centuries and over, you know, the lives of several saints and sages, you start seeing that they have set an example of how to do this. How do you lead your life in such a way that every moment is an offering, that every moment is a dedication to the Lord? And he says, the title of this fifth chapter is The Identity of Bhakti and Jnana. So, the previous chapter was how Swami said you should use your life itself as a sacrifice, as a yajna. And this is the identity of bhakti and jnana. So, what is this bhakti and jnana? You know, some people take pride in saying, oh, I follow the karma marga. And some people say, I follow the bhakti marga. And some people say, no, I follow the jnana marga. And in this chapter, Swami is calling three of them and saying, hello, all three of you are following the same path. And he says, there is absolutely no difference between karma, bhakti and jnana. This first paragraph in this chapter is so beautiful. Swami says, there is no distinction between bhakti and jnana. Just as saguna becomes nirguna, bhakti also becomes jnana. So he says, when you start worshipping the Lord with a form, with an attribute, with love, when you start worshipping the Lord with, identification of Him with a form, slowly that transmutes, that goes into a level where you realize that that same Lord is Nirguna as well, is the eternal omnipresent power. That divine energy is the same Lord. He will say, then Swami says here, I will not agree that karma, bhakti and jnana are separate. I do not even like to classify one of these as the first, this other, second and the next, the third. I will not accept a mixture of all these three even, a merger of the three. Karma is bhakti and bhakti is jnana. Now this is the beautiful, this is the greatest good fortune that we have that, you know, when we read some of Swami's writings and listen to his discourses, the way Swami explains the most difficult and complicated themes with such a contemporary and a daily life analogy that you will never forget. Here Swami says, a block of Mysore Pak has sweetness, weight and shape. The three cannot be separated one from the other. Each little part of it has sweetness, weight and shape. We do not find shape in one part, weight in another and sweetness in the third. And when it is placed on the tongue, the taste is recognized, weight is lessened and shape is modified all at the same time. So too the jiva, the atma and the paramatma are not separate. They are one and the same. I mean, who can compare a Mysore Pak to the jiva, the atma and paramatma? So if you look at it, Swami is talking about the karma, bhakti, jnana. And he says, it is like a Mysore Pak. He says, you cannot have a difference between the weight, the shape and the taste. So all three are one. So also the jiva, the individual soul, the atma and the paramatma are one. And there is no distinction. If you say, it's like I follow only karma marga, that is I follow only the shape of the Mysore Pak. I follow bhakti marga, I look at only the sweetness aspect of the Mysore Pak. Swami is saying that they are one and the same. All three are part of the same Mysore Pak. I think this is one of the most amazing and beautiful analogies that we see in this chapter in Premavahini. He says, when all these three come together, when every action that you do is done in the spirit of seva, prema and jnana, he says that is called Purushottama Yoga. What is Purushottama Yoga? He says, when karma, bhakti, jnana, all three come together as an offering, when every action is done with this kind of a unison, that is called Purushottama Yoga. And he says, that has to be practiced and not spoken in words. Sadhana should be done constantly with ever-expanding heart full of bhakti and jnana. The sweetness of the Lord's name is the charm of life. It brings great internal joy. So constantly chanting the name of the Lord itself is karma. It itself is bhakti, and that leads you to the jnana, that the Lord is not limited to this form but is the supreme power. And it, in fact, tattvamasi, as Swami said, you yourself are part of that Atman or divine power. He says, when every action is offered to God, what it results in is your good is taken care, the higher good is taken care, and the highest good. He says, swartha, parartha, paramartha, all three become one. So when you offer every action to the Lord, swartha, that is your goodness, goodness for you, your fulfillment, then the higher good and the highest good, swartha, parartha, paramartha, all become one. And he says, first I and you becomes we, then we and he becomes one. And this is the significance of Om Tat Sat. Today, yesterday and tomorrow, Om Tat Sat was and will be. He and I are there always. So he says, slowly you move from seeing separation between you and the Lord to having Om Tat Sat, to showing that all three are one. And he says, the sadhana is also always there. So when you are living your life, you have to act. You cannot, stop action. You cannot say, okay, I think I'll just lie down for the whole day. But that is action in itself. So you have to act. And when you are acting, you are doing action. So he says, offer that action to the Lord. And that itself is sadhana. So sadhana is also always there. He says, just as the sun is inseparable and is never apart from its rays, under no circumstance should any aspirant be without his sadhana. It is only when the sadhak adheres to this sadhana in such an incessant manner can he be said to be one with Om. Om, which is the fundamental, the primordial sound. He says, if you want to be one with Om, you have to be doing your sadhana all the time. So this is what Swami is talking about in the fifth chapter. And when you go to the next chapter, he says, you may do your best, as Swami is saying. You have to do sadhana all the time. But does that mean you are alone? Is God just going to stand and watch you? Maybe suffer, seeing you suffer, or maybe seeing you fail, maybe seeing you trying very hard. What is God's role? This entire chapter is basically just one paragraph, and I think I'll just read out the entire chapter because it is so beautiful. Swami says, the blemishes of the heart have to be washed by the moral life and the doing of one's duty. A time may come when man becomes tired and weak, but he should then pray thus, Lord, things have gone beyond my capacity. I feel further effort is too great a strain. Give me strength, O Lord. So here is Bhagwan teaching us how we should pray to the Lord, what we should pray to the Lord. So when you have put your best effort, when you have really done your sadhana, and at a time may come when you are really tired, you can say, Lord, please give me the strength. And then how does the Lord respond? This is a very, very beautiful paragraph. He says, at first, God stands at a distance, watching man's efforts, like the teacher who stands apart when the students write out answers to the questions. Then when the man sheds his attachment to bhoga, that is enjoyment and material life, and takes to good deeds and seva, God comes encouragingly near. For he is like Surya Narayana, who stands waiting outside the closed door. Surya Narayana is basically like the sun god. He says, God is like the sun god who stands waiting outside the closed door, like the servant who knows the rights of the master and his own limitations. So what Swami is saying is that the Lord himself is like your servant. He is just standing at your doorstep. He knows his limitations. He does not announce his presence or bang the door. He simply waits. And when the master just open the door a little, the sun rushes in and promptly drives out darkness from within. So he says, when the door is locked, the entire energy, the great power of the sun is just halted right outside the door. So also, when our doors are closed, the Lord is standing right outside the house. When you open the door a little bit, the light rushes in and clears all darkness. He says, when his help is asked for, he is present by the side of man with hands extended to render assistance. So what is wanted from man is only the discrimination, the viveka, to pray to the Lord, the wisdom to remember him. So when we are going through life and we feel enough is enough and we feel, oh my God, I've given my best. Oh Lord, please give me the strength. So when you pray to him, remember that he's standing right outside the house waiting for you to just give out that one prayer. The moment you give out that one prayer, the Lord comes rushing in. So moving quickly to the next chapter, the seventh chapter, Swami says, Sadguna is Jnana. So he says in the previous chapter that we have to pray to the Lord, and that Jnana, that wisdom to remember him, is what is needed in trying times in our lives. But what is this Jnana? How do we develop this Jnana? He says, Jnana is not an intellectual feat. It is not some knowledge that you have to acquire. Jnana is Sadguna. Doing good actions, you know, doing good deeds is what is Jnana. He says, Jnana means understanding, but it is not just an intellectual feat. Eating does not mean the placing of food on the tongue. Eating is worthwhile only when the food is chewed and swallowed and digested and assimilated in the bloodstream and transformed into muscle and bone, into strength and vigor. So too, understanding or Jnana must permeate and invigorate all the moments of life. It must be expressed through all the organs and senses, through all the karmendriyas and all the gyanendriyas. To this high stage man must reach. Mere accumulation of learning is not Jnana. Only Sadguna is Jnana. So he says, just like, you know, you place food on your tongue, you have to chew it. It's not equivalent to actually eating the food. You have to chew it. You have to, you know, take it in. Only then the essence of the food gets assimilated into your body. So also he says, this Jnana must permeate every moment of your life. It's not some intellectual understanding that, oh, I know this and it's good for me to talk on a Thursday life or to go and give a talk to somebody else or to inspire or show my knowledge. And that is not Jnana. He says it has to permeate every action in your daily life. So he says, when it comes to the manifestation of Jnana in daily life, every action has to become a yajna. So again Swami is talking about this yajna. Again Swami is talking about this concept of sacrifice. So the sacrifice is every action is offered as an offering into this sacrifice, into this yajna. And he says the food that we eat is in order to keep the body fit for this yajna. So in one of the previous chapters Swami said, this body is given to you. Why is this body given to you? It is given to you so that you can offer this body itself as a part of the yajnam for the sacrifice. The moment you have come over this attachment to the material life. So here he says, this body is given to you in order to continue to do this yajnam, in order to continue to do this sacrifice. He says, eating is a part of the worship. It is not udara poshanam. It is not something which you do for just enjoying. You know, we go and have a party and we eat and all that. All that is not important, he says. Yes, you may go and you may eat, but why are you eating? Why are you nourishing this body? What is the purpose of keeping this body? He says the purpose of keeping this body is only for this yajnam, the sacrifice, where every action is offered to the Lord. And he says that is the manifestation of Jnana in daily life. So what is the sign of manifestation of Jnana in daily life? A person who is filled with wisdom will have every action of his very measured, will have every action of his very deliberate and very, very, you know, pure. It will be a pure offering to the Lord. You know, here I am, of course, I am summarizing chapters in this session, but I can't help recount a very sweet and a beautiful incident that happened when we were in our school days. You know, this was sometime in the winter vacation and most of the students had gone home. Some of us who had stayed back, we had the opportunity of coming for darshan every day morning and evening. And since we were staying with our parents, we had the opportunity of, you know, taking either the clove which Swami would take, or some of us would bring this groundnuts. So what would happen is the groundnuts would be fried and the husk on top would be removed. And the white groundnuts, we would bring it in a small bowl. And Swami would take the groundnuts and often throw it to all the students, like he would throw the toffees or the chocolates and the yellow grains. And sometimes he would take one groundnut and put it in his mouth. So one of these days, when we had this bowl of groundnuts, Swami was in a different mood and he came straight to us and he said, "Hey boy, you get up, you get up, you get up." So three of us were having groundnuts in the bowls and Swami said, "What will the devotees think? From the distance they are looking at me and they are saying all these boys are bringing groundnuts and Swami is eating these groundnuts and Swami is putting on weight. And Swami is, the devotees are thinking that I am becoming a sapatrama." Sapatrama is a term used for somebody who keeps eating. For people who have stayed with Swami, who have seen Swami, you know, having his food, you realize that he hardly eats anything. But this is a way of saying that you should stop getting these groundnuts. But I just got reminded of this because he says, eating is a part of worship. And if you really see how Swami eats, it is bare minimum. Of course, Swami makes sure that your plate is full and he makes sure that you are served all the items. But the way he led his life is he ate minimum what was required. And on that day in the veranda, Swami said, "Don't bring these groundnuts again because the devotees are thinking that I am eating all these groundnuts and I am putting on weight." We all know how perfect Swami was. He never put on weight, but that's his love. He just wanted to, you know, pull this up with us and then teach us that lesson. So moving back again to this summary of this chapter 7, he says all karma should be done for the sake of these three entities. So what are these three entities? He says to utilize the world for the worship of the Lord, to establish peace and justice in society, and to control and coordinate the functions of the body. So you have to control the functions of this, coordinate the functions of the body to establish peace and justice in society and to use this nature and the world as a worship for the Lord. So when you start seeing this nature, this world as which is given to you as an opportunity to worship the Lord, that is sanctifying your life. And he says, the first is called yajna, the second is called dana, and the third is called tapas. So when you are able to coordinate the functions of this body, that is called tapas. And all human acts must subserve these three needs. So these three needs are very, very important. And so when you look at how we have to utilize this body, how we have to use this life as a sacrifice, to know what, like Swami already mentioned in one of the chapters before, Tattvamasi. Then he says, the next chapter, the eighth chapter, he says, truth is God. An ethical life is the foundation of all spiritual life. What is an ethical life? An ethical life is based on the discrimination between truth and falsehood. The body and atma are separate. He says, constantly live in that awareness, constantly be aware that the body and the atma are separate. This discrimination is needed for all aspects of life, secular and spiritual. This is the truth. This truth is God. So ultimately, the goal of all our sadhana is to achieve this truth, to realize this truth, and this truth, which is God, is that the body and the atma are separate. So, however, he says, man has to perform all his duties. He cannot escape. There's no way of escaping. You have to perform all your duties, keeping this aim of self-realization in mind. How do you start? He says, the food that you eat every day, that should be pure. Purity of food is very, very essential. And he says, that is the first step. Like, listeners, you would have, you must remember, the kind of foods that Swami has spoken about in the 1990 Samashava series. Swami said, what we eat through the mouth is not the only food. What we see is food, what we hear is food, anything that we take in through the five senses, all that is type of food. And he says, purity is very important. What you see, what you hear, what you smell, what you eat, purity is very important. And he says, in this material world, one cannot, like if you have not experienced the joy of a spiritual life, how will you know its value? How will you know the purity, the energy, the, you know, the joy, the bliss that you get by leading a spiritual life. He gives a beautiful analogy here. He says, it is like, you know, swimming can be learnt only after entering the water. So also the joy of a spiritual life can be experienced only when you plunge into spiritual sadhana with a float attached to the mind. You go and stand on the edge of the swimming pool and you say, I want the experience of swimming and then I'll jump into the water. No, that's not possible. So the moment you jump into the water, you will get the experience of swimming. So he says, attach this float to your mind. Tell the mind that there is a higher life, there is a higher purpose in life, and start your spiritual sadhana. When you start that sadhana, you will experience the joy of spiritual sadhana and that will propel you further. He says, Paramatma alone is real, Paramatma is truth, Paramatma is love. Meditate on him as truth, as love. It is possible to realize him in whatever form you meditate on. Be always in the company of his devotees. Through this satsanga, discrimination and detachment, that is viveka and vairagya, will be implanted and increased. So, satsangatve nisangatvam. So, he says the first step is, be in the company of his devotees and that will spark this discrimination and vairagya. And these will strengthen the spirit and endow you with inner peace. Your mind will then merge in Paramatma. He says, use all the strength and talent you have been given in speaking and acting truthfully. By your behavior and way of life, you can realize the truth, which is God. So in this chapter 8, which is titled Truth is God, Swami says, that truth, that Atman, that, you know, that being can be realized. First, you have to start with an ethical life. And what is the ethical life? He says, ethical life is based on the discrimination between what is truth and what is falsehood. And what is truth is that the body and the Atma are separate. And he says, that you can do. Discrimination is needed in all aspects of life, secular and spiritual. So only when you have discrimination in every aspect, saying that the body and the Atma are different, only then you will realize this truth. So this is what Swami says. And of course, Swami says the Paramatma alone is real. So, you know, this, the joy of experiencing a spiritual life, the joy of having leading a life of spiritual sadhana, can be got only when you dive into it, when you actually get into it. So he says, God is real, God is love. Meditate on God, any form or name will do. And then you will achieve this truth. So coming to this last chapter for today, he says, yes, you have to do this, you have to go ahead. But what is the obstacle? Obviously, there are obstacles. Otherwise, all of us would have got self-realized by now and we would all, you know, be living in that bliss. But he says, there is an obstacle. And what is that obstacle? He says, ahankara causes ashanti. Ahankara or ego. The first paragraph of this ninth chapter, he says, man creates and develops in himself an abounding variety of selfish habits and attitudes, and he gives rise to great discomfort for himself. The impulse for all this comes from the power complex, the greed for accumulating authority, domination and power, the greed for things which can never be eternal and full. In fact, it is impossible for man to attain them. It is impossible for man to attain them up to the level of satiation. Omnipotence belongs to Sarveshwara, the Lord of all. Such a beautiful paragraph. He says, the mind, in fact, if you look at all these qualities of, you know, power, greed for power, the power complex and greed for accumulating authority, dominion and wealth and all these things. He says, all these things cloud us. And, you know, we become egoistic. The moment you have some knowledge, you have some wisdom, you have some power, you are egoistic. He says, do not forget, the only powerful, the all-powerful one is the Lord. The Lord is the source of everything. He says, you may have some art, you may have some expertise in art, you may have some knowledge, you may have some wealth, but do not pride yourself, do not fill yourself with ahankara, and do not fill yourself with egoism, pride, conceit. He says, man should never forget that God has bestowed it on him. Even if he has earned it with his hard work, you may earn something with your hard work, but then, even if you have earned it with your hard work, you should always remember that God has given it to you. Who has given it to you? If you have acquired art, from where has that art come? It has come from God. If you have acquired wealth, where has that wealth come from? It has come from God. So he says, in that way, you will not be egoistic. The effulgence of Atma is obscured by Ahankara. You know, in the 1990 Samashava series, Swami was, mentioning that this Ahankara or Aham plus Akara, that is, identification with this body is so powerful and it is the subtlest hindrance. It is more powerful than the mind. The mind itself, the antakarnas are divided into mano, buddhi, chitta, ahankara. Ahankara, which is the last stage of the mind, it's the subtlest aspect of the mind which binds the sense of I to this body. Aham plus akara. So he says when it binds to the body, it blocks the vision of the Atma. It is like a cardboard that blocks the vision of the sun. The sun is all powerful. The sun is there, out there, but a small cardboard can block the vision of the sun. He says, power without the actual realization of bliss of the self is like a wall without the basement. So what happens is, what is real power? What is real bliss? He says, only when you experience that Atman, when you experience that oneness with the Lord, that is real power. Every other power is like a huge wall without any basement, which it can fall anytime. And what is this power, this panditri? You have this knowledge, you have really more knowledge, you want to show your expertise in different fields. He says, but this is of no use. When you have this feeling, I know, he says, that is only ego. How do you get over this ego? The only way of getting over this ego is constantly remembering that it is the Lord who has bestowed this ability on you. To show the difference between, vain talk and, scholarship versus the real experience, Swami gives one of the most brilliant, beautiful analogies. He says, you take the Panchanga. The Panchanga is a traditional Hindu calendar which predicts the rains and, predicts the weather and predicts good days and bad dates and everything. He says, you take the Panchanga and then squeeze it, fold it several times and squeeze it several times. Will you get rain? He'll say, no, it's just a Panchangam. You will not get the rain by squeezing the Panchangam. In the same way, the Vedas, the Shastras and the Upanishads, all these are pointers. He says, by reading them and becoming a scholar, it is not enough. What you have to do is put them into practice. And he says, the way you have to put them into practice is, you have to get rid of this ego which says, I know. The moment you have this ego that I know all, the fall is inevitable. This delusion causes death. The secret of salvation lies in the realization of this danger. Rebirth is inevitable if this danger is not averted. The moment you have this feeling that I know all, this ego, he says, rebirth is inevitable. So this is a big danger that we have to actually overcome. He says, only when you have the knowledge and reality awakens in you, you can overcome the meaningless noise of argumentation, disputation and exhibitionist flamboyance. So basically what happens, we have heard this beautiful saying which says, empty vessels makes more noise. So you know a little bit, and you have some knowledge and you want to show it off. You want to tell everybody, you want to share. But Swami says that is not the yardstick of having experienced divine bliss. When you experience divine bliss, you will be in a state of complete surrender where you will be aware that every ability that you have, everything that you have been bestowed with is the grace of the Lord. Only the Lord is all powerful, omnipotent, omnipresent and omniscient. And the Lord has given you this. The moment you have this attitude, there is no place for ego. So dear listeners, I don't know how good this effort has been in trying to summarize the first 9 chapters of this beautiful book, Prema Vahini. I know I have left out a lot of points, but for want of time, and for trying to build a sort of continuity between the topics that Swami has touched upon, I might have omitted a few points and I might have laid more emphasis on certain points. But this is done to the best of my ability. And I would really request you, dear listeners, to send your feedback And please point out if I missed out anything important so that we might add it in the next session and add it to the summary of this beautiful Prema Vahini. Offering my most humble pranams and offering this whole program at the lotus feet of Bhagwan, I bring this session to a close. Again, requesting you, dear listeners, that there is no substitute to reading the book again and again. In fact, the moment I read the first chapter again to summarize it for this, for today's presentation, I was completely awestruck and really started wondering, did we ever read this chapter before? Did we ever read this chapter before? Every time you read it, it's so fresh. Every time you read it, it's so relevant. It's so beautiful. And I think you read it now, you read it 5 years later, you read it 10 years later, along with your own internal growth, Swami's words always acquire a new meaning for us in this journey towards Himself. So dear listeners, please take time to read the original, and if you have any suggestions, please do share with us at feedback@radiosai.org. Just one point before I bring this program to an end. Let us picturize Bhagwan sitting on his chair. There are a few photographs you see. Swami sitting and writing with so much of love. Some of the students who have actually seen Swami sitting and writing these articles said that there was absolutely no thought. There was no thought. It would just flow from his pen. He would sit, hold a small notebook or a few sheets of paper, and he would just start writing. These words are verily direct words from Bhagwan. So these words are themselves Bhagwan. This wisdom itself is Bhagwan. So let us follow, let us do our best in following what Swami has written and complete this journey of life that is merging into Him. Offering this effort at Swami's lotus feet, Sai Ram, and have a good night.